I guess, but I feel like chicken feathers are not as soft as goose down.
Yeah, well, goose down's not soft. When it starts to needle your ears to death.
Also true.
So, potato, potato.
Asking the important questions.
So if you know, leave a comment. Yeah, if you're an ornithologist, leave us a comment. All right,
we're getting in some weeds here, people. Okay.
Welcome to the podcast where your hosts sample a different scotch each season while we dive into current social, political, and economic issues each episode. This is Scotch and Socialism.
We unpacked our adjectives. Sorry, Schoolhouse Rock. I'm Griff, your resident throwback educational video connoisseur for the evening.
I'm Jake, your resident millennial staring into the abyss.
Not screaming into the abyss.
No, just staring today.
It's all right. I'm gonna be Russ, and I'm gonna be the abyss.
This got very Nietzsche all of a sudden. I don't know if I like this.
Yeah, Nietzsche's a douche.
Wow, just straight for the throat.
I mean, am I wrong?
Thus spoke Jake Athustra.
What are we talking about tonight, guys?
Just a light fare.
Light and easy stuff?
Light and easy stuff, like, sterilization of history, or as some call it, not inappropriately whitewashing history. Yeah, we're gonna tear apart all of your favorite people from history. Brace yourselves, children.
Spoiler alert. Everybody is horrible.
Everyone's horrible and everything sucks. You're welcome. Good night.
Wasn't that a song title from somebody? Like, I swear it was.
I wouldn't be surprised. Would not be surprised.
So start us off, Griff. Who's the candidate you like the most for the most heinous crimes?
I feel like we should get a little bit of boilerplate in here first. I don't know, man.
A little
too fast?
Maybe. Yeah, Jake, go ahead.
I guess... maybe talking about personal experiences with sterilized history, I suppose. I think the biggest one for us is probably going to be like the founding of the United States and like personal.
Put that in air quotes.
Founding.
For an audio only podcast.
Air quote, founding.
Yeah.
Air quote.
The tone is there.
But like, this kind of leads into modern politics quite a lot, this idea of sterilized history, because like even within the evangelical side of the church that I was in for so long, I remember towards, you know, the pandemic, and then there was the BLM movement got really going again during 2020, and there was the 1619 project.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. It was New York Times.
I need to read through the whole thing. It was a huge project done by a writer for the New York Times, and the evangelical churches went freaking nuts.
A lot of more conservative sections of society did.
Yeah, and it was just like this whole like, how dare you say anything bad about our founding fathers? And they were just the most amazing people. And slavery was never part of the founding of America. It's literally in our Constitution, but, you know.
We'll get into that later.
Yeah.
But this is a timely topic, but also not. I was not in the sense that it's not something that's just come up in the last year. I think it's been ongoing. Right. I think it's seen more of a public visible resurgence in the last year, especially because we've started really publicly questioning and loudly questioning why we have monuments to some pretty terrible people. And as most things do, it kind of spills over from that starting point. I was reading an article in the Smithsonian Magazine, I think, about a teacher who in 1996 was trying to make a book list for their political theory class. They're a professor in college, not just a teacher. And they pulled Thomas Jefferson. I don't remember which book or treatise he wrote that they pulled, but it was because, you know, he was a slaveholder, which... I think that's complicated. The idea of pulling a book specifically because of the author's
affiliation at the time with questionable things.
I think personally it's kind of limiting.
Yeah.
You don't have to lionize the author. You know, you can still get good material, good thought from the book.
Given one of the people we're going to talk about tonight, at least one of them, I can't not be for that, or not be for.
I can't not be for that.
Maybe. Wow.
Oh,
did you not?
The linguist.
So many.
The linguist in me just died a little bit.
Griff is like ready to stab me. But no, like if we're talking about, you know, trying to remove authors from
curricula,
I guess. Yeah, from education, because of, you know, some horrid merit. There's a lot of authors that we take, and a lot of not just literary authors, but like scientific achievements and stuff like that, that we take for granted now, that were built on some pretty horrible things.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know what to do with that.
In what
way? On a personal note, like, it just feels icky, but that's like, well, there's.
Let's go into that a little bit. I think that sounds interesting. What do you? Unpack that when you say, I don't know what to do. That feels kind of icky. Like,
well, I mean, it's like the advancements that we have, and I'm not purely talking scientific advancements, but there were things that we kind of got out of Nazi research.
Oh, there
like
was
that.
A lot of things we a got out of Nazi research
that we now take take for granted really today. Right. Like, you know, if we were just wholesale going to chuck that, it's going to drag our civilization back a lot. And it's going, like, there are health related things that we've gotten out of.
Well, it's because a lot of those health related things came from experiments done on Jewish prisoners and concentration camps,
which I think
objectively terrible.
Yeah. It's horrible. And so like there's the gut reaction to a lot of things like that, to just chuck out anything that we could learn from it. But there's also the opposite side where we just refuse to talk. Now, the Nazi experimentation stuff, I think we at least do I don't think we do enough. I think we do at least a modicum of effort teaching, like, hey, these things were done at great and horrible, dark costs.
You have to contextualize it.
Right. But we also refuse, like in the case of our founding fathers, especially in conservative circles, to admit that anything was wrong for them. Yeah. We glorify these scions of history.
I feel like we do that a lot in just general, right? We'll pick someone, or we'll pick a group, and it's either they're on the good side or they're on the bad side. And we kind of ignore all the other stuff, right? Yeah. Like there's a few notable items that came from, you know, one person, or a few notable items came from another, but we kind of glaze over the rest of like their past, other things they might have been part of, even possibly leading in. I mean, that's the other fun thing, right? Just because they're known for something doesn't necessarily mean that was their entire cause. That may have just been a facet of it.
See, I think that hits on something. What you said there, Russ, about, you know, they're known for something may not be their whole cause. I think that's where you really open the door for a lot of, you got to be really intentional with the contextualizing you're doing. So one kind of low hanging fruit instance we can look at comparison wise are, you know, the original founding fathers, Jefferson, Madison's, Thomas Paine, so forth, Washington, and Confederate generals and leaders. I don't want to call them governors, but, you know, Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee and Edmund Pettus and people like that. And yeah, it gets extremely complicated because a lot of the quote unquote founding fathers, I think there's generally about probably 17 or 18 of them that are kind of considered the, you know, the band. Over half of them were slave owners, Washington included, Jefferson included. There were a lot of former presidents who owned slaves. And what's really tricky, and I read this also from that Smithsonian Magazine article, is that while they were active slaveholders, they were not only kind of creating the framework of the country for what it would be, but they were also tussling with this notion of owning slaves. Jefferson even wrote, you know, the institution of slavery corrupts the enslaved as well as the slave owner. But Jefferson had slaves and had, you know, non-consensual relations with his slaves probably. And in that way was a pretty terrible role model, or just, you know, person in general. You know, I don't know if Washington went so far with his slaves, but we don't attach that historical element, those artifacts, to those individuals. But we're very quick to do that with members of the Confederacy. And so you really, I think it boils down to how much are you willing to give up or gloss over in looking for the positive effects these people had on the history of the country. I think that's where, yeah, we're willing to give a little rope to, you know, the original founding fathers, and not, well, large swaths of the country are not willing to give a lot of slack to Confederate leaders and generals and stuff.
Sure. I also feel like there's a level of the people writing the history may have also obfuscated or omitted data sets as well, you know, because we have some data from those people, you know, in regards to their own writings and how they interacted with slaves and whatnot. But I also feel like there's probably a good portion that may have just been lost to history, right? And that may have been intentional, you know, depending on who was around them. It's like, well, this may look bad in the future. Let's get rid of some of this.
Let's just tear that page out.
Yeah, no one needs to see that one, you know. And unfortunately, we don't know if that ever happened. And so it's speculation on either side, you know, realistically, whether everyone was completely for something or not against something or whatever. I mean, they have what's available. But I think that's part of the sterilization is people at the time looking at something going, this may not age well, you know, almost like political advisors.
Yeah.
That are like, you know, this is not something that needs to be out in the public. We're going to cover this up. We're going to cause other things to happen that may be more grandiose so that we have something to put in the books because we need to hide this.
Agree, but that's where it gets tricky because that, I mean, you're kind of talking about something that borders on, you know, foresight. Trying to predict the future. And in 1775, they had no idea what, you know, 2021 was going
to
look like.
But it's not to say that some curator in a museum in 1850 decided that there was a book that needed to go away.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
You know, and that's the thing is we try our best to preserve history. And the problem is it's really up to the people preserving it to ensure that quality, right?
Right. And we put a lot of trust in those people. Because, yeah. I mean, we've all probably heard the idiom history is written by the winners.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
You know, and sometimes I don't think that's problematic. Sometimes it is because sometimes the winners quote unquote won through very morally questionable ways. Other times it's a little more cut and dry.
Absolutely. You know,
like World War II is a really easy example. And if you think about the portrayal of Nazis in popular culture, film, media, so forth, they are almost never given any sympathy or slack or anything.
Oh, no.
Like, there's never any question. Like, you look at that movies about Vietnam or about Afghanistan or Korea or other theaters in World War II, and, okay, there's like, okay, well, how bad really was this? How were the, you know, the North Vietnamese really so awful? I don't know, you know. But
well, I think we've seen mediums where, like, Americans were almost portrayed as, enemies and invaders and all that good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like, I went to Vietnam twice within the last 4 years and had the chance to walk through the War Museum in Ho Chi Minh City. Excellent. And
that'd be an experience.
Oh, my goodness.
Did you feel awkward? I'm asking genuinely. Did you feel awkward?
A little bit.
Okay.
I have probably too much of an ability to disassociate. Sure. And like there was actually, I think, certainly differing sides, arguably some propaganda. Sure. There was actually, I think, a lot of grace given to the American soldiers.
Really?
And even some of the fighting, like to the concept of like they were following orders and they didn't understand. Now, there was very harsh criticism, as there should be, for the American soldiers who went out and committed atrocities.
Right.
Sure.
Raping and pillaging of villages and defenseless people. Civilians, however, there was a decent amount, arguably, of grace also held within there. Now, there was also the floor, and it deserved a floor because of how awful it is, dedicated to the chemical warfare that happened.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, I had heard, like, going through history class here, U.S. history, we spent, gosh, maybe a week on the Vietnam War.
Right.
Maybe. I think it was wrapped up with a few other things, too. Like, it certainly wasn't.
Wars abroad. Here's your week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Vietnam for a day and a half.
Yeah.
Agent Orange.
And what? They mention Agent Orange and, like, yeah, it deforested a whole bunch. And there were some
side effects.
No.
Yeah.
There are generational generational genetic issues now that we caused, not just with Agent Orange. Agent Orange is, I think, the worst of all of them.
Probably.
Or at least the most used, yeah. I think. Yeah. But there was a lot of chemical warfare that happened, and I met people. They were part of the aftermath of that.
Absolutely.
And they have disabilities or deformities or whatever.
Well, we don't like...
But we sterilize that part of the history here because we're the quote-unquote victor.
I mean, I don't know about in Vietnam.
I quote-unquote. We portray it that way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not a war that we profoundly lost.
Right.
You know? And, you know, we can bring it back to World War II. We as Americans are often portrayed as like the gallant, you know, square jawed, tough heroes. I mean, yeah, we did help beat fascism, but it wasn't like, you know, we were, it's not really what you see in Band of Brothers, you know what I mean? Or Saving Private Ryan.
We didn't ride in on our white horse and
no,
save
we
the
rode
day.
In on, so much. We rode in on firebombing Tokyo and firebombing Dresden, which a lot of people said that was probably uncalled for, you know, and firebombing especially. I mean, I don't know if we had napalm back in World War II, but I don't even know how to describe it. The horrifying reality of firebombing a major city because you destroy so much infrastructure, but also cause so much human casualty.
Oh, yeah.
Civilian.
Yeah, you can't really have a targeted strike. Like, okay, we're going to hit this one tank factory with two bombs. Okay, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. No, we're just going to carpet bomb this entire city with basically explosive incendiary munitions. Mm-hmm. And whatever happens, you know. That's not something you learn, at least I didn't, and hopefully history classes have changed, doubtful. And you know, in high school or even a lot of college history, you know, because if it's something we're proud of, and this kind of makes a certain amount of sense. If it's something we're proud of or something we can easily-ish defend,
yeah,
we're much more amenable to putting it to writing it down.
Oh, absolutely. Basically. Yeah, that's kind of the thing, right? The ability to find some of this data is hard in America. Like researching stuff on the internet is one thing because it's global, which I think it's really enabled a lot of people to understand what actually is happening around the world, as opposed to being very shut off and being kind of
cloistered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to come back to that, but continue.
No, go ahead. Unless you're not actually
hand off.
Yeah.
No, like I think because, and we've talked kind of about this in the past, the internet is incredibly new.
It is.
Like for us, it feels rather old because it's been around for most of our lives. But in the
remember, he's the young one.
He's the little. When were you born, Jake?
93.
He's a year older than the
I
internet.
Said most, not all.
Sorry.
Shove it.
Get him some scotch. But
this idea of global communication, largely without censure, largely.
Largely. I mean, there are pockets, right?
Sure.
Still very censored, or at least attempt to be.
And certainly almost no censure in the States.
Oh, yeah. Well, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, you get could theoretically get pockets of it, and it depends on what we're classifying as censorship.
Well, and I would say it depends on the platform as well, right?
Right.
Like there are options that are available that are like, completely uncensored.
Facebook may shut off things that they disagree with, whether or not that's correct or incorrect is not what I'm getting into.
That's later.
Get that's vaccinated. Episode. But anyways, you can as an American with a relatively small amount of money set up your own website and put pretty much whatever you want on there, aside from a few things that the ATF is probably going to get a little angry with you.
Well, and they might contact you, FCC. But realistically, not necessarily.
No, I'm talking
he's talking
like,
about specifically terrorism related stuff.
Understood.
At least I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah, because the FCC doesn't care what you put on a website, by the way. They really don't.
No.
Oh, that's
they
good
care
know.
If you muck around with protocols that you're not supposed to.
Or play with frequencies that you're not supposed to.
Yeah,
of course.
But, yeah, and so it's like we, while, you know, it feels like, it can feel like there's a lot of censorship for certainly us in the States. There's pretty much none.
No.
And so
there are forums available to us that if we really want to voice our opinions, regardless of what
there
they are.
So many ways.
Even if they are terrorist related, illegal or otherwise, there are forums for those too, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah. They just get dropped and then spring up in other places.
Yep, exactly.
And so anyway, sorry, back to my original point. this idea that suddenly, and I'm speaking again from my experience in much more conservative and evangelical circles, the left is out to change history and spreading lies and things.
Aren't those just lies propagated from the right?
Right. Well, I think we should be careful
dividing it left and right. Right, because
if there hasn't been, there probably has been, but there's certainly the possibility.
Sure. Well, there are groups within groups.
I mean, right, exactly. But this, you know, this sudden idea of like America wasn't founded like that or whatever. It's like, no, it was. It's you didn't have access to the information outside of your particular spheres.
Think about how much just information, and this is a very blanket term, just how much information about this country's past is out there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, just it's, I would say probably incalculable.
It's definitely unfathomable. Like if you actually wanted to do research on something, I'm sure you could always find documents for and against mm-hmm. almost anything you look up. But obviously, taking the time to verify the information and whatnot.
This is where I think the nebulousness of the internet can be a positive thing. You know, it's like you can just throw all of this information out there, and in doing so, you're going to have a greater chance of actually distilling the truth from it, though you will have substantially more labor to do so.
Sure.
Or you'll have to exert more effort to do so, which falls on, you know, us educating as kind of the onus of responsibility there. So it's hard, you know, but I do think that it could be worthwhile in the long run because I think history should be taught with warts and all. Lenses, no tint, yes. No anything.
Yeah, but that requires they update their textbooks from 1983.
I don't think
1983 is rather new.
Yeah, I don't even think it needs to be updated. I mean, yeah, there, obviously stuff has happened since 1983, regardless of what YouTube would have you believe.
Sorry, that was actually a strike against the fact that they couldn't get funding to get new textbooks, even if they had new data. So.
Oh, well played.
Also that.
Well played. I was just going to say you could use an old textbook as an example of whitewashed history. Like a lot of public school districts in the South, they still have textbooks where it's, you know, very kind of kid gloves talking about the Klan and talking about mm-hmm. the CSA and, you know, the Daughters of the Confederacy who drove a lot of those.
Which in the Pacific Northwest, movements. I don't believe I had any of that in my high school classes or even my college classes.
Any of what?
Most of the Confederacy at all. Like it existed, right. It was bad, moving on. Like that was kind of what it was. It was kind of a glossed over area. It's like, oh yeah, slavery bad, moving on. But we never talked about like the individual like groups. We never talked about like some of their ideals. We never mm-hmm. talked about like why they were doing what they were doing. It was very limited.
That depends on, see, this is where it gets very tricky because what were they doing depends on who you ask.
Absolutely.
It depends on how much you read. Because a lot of people who will jump to defend keeping Confederate statues or segregationist statues, like, well, it's our history. They were fighting for their, you know, rights and freedoms and states' rights. And it's like, you've never read the Articles of Confederation mm-hmm. or not the Articles of Confederation, sorry. You never read the Articles of Secession, mm-hmm. have you? Because if you did, there's like 80 instances in those articles where it says slavery. Like that was the driving force. Like, yes, it was states' rights to own slaves.
Yes.
That's the long and short of it. Sorry. You know, maybe we shouldn't have these statues up anymore. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and that's
itself, you know, not to cut you off, but that's, sorry, Jake, but that's kind of a form of, in itself of sterilization of the history, right? It's the removal of these statues and these prominent figures.
That's certainly an argument that could be made, and people will often bring up examples of like the concentration camps at Auschwitz and the other ones are still there.
Yeah.
The difference is the motive behind.
Sure.
They're not glorified.
Well, right. That's just it, right? There is always going to be people who try. There are always going to be people who are against. And I feel like a lot of this stuff is which way is the wind blowing today? Like if there just happens to be enough momentum one day, we start doing all these things like, oh, we look at all these statues we need to take down. That wasn't a thing for the last God knows how long. We suddenly decided that there was a problem.
Well,
which is fine.
Not was it a bad thing. Was it not a thing at all, or was it not a thing in the public context?
I don't think there was enough public outcry. I think it's a good way to put it. There wasn't enough people who were aware of it, probably, to actually have an opinion, which I think helps. You know, and obviously, again, with this global information ability, suddenly it's like, oh, there's a statue in this town that represents a slave owner. Interesting. I now have an opinion about this because now I'm aware of it. You know, and I feel like that's kind of a thing that's happening is we're almost like unearthing little pockets of history that have always been there. People have always been aware of them.
Right.
But now the global, you know,
are you going to say global elites?
I don't want to say, I don't want to say elites. I want to say just the general people who have problems with random stuff in the world because they enjoy having problems with stuff. Does that make sense?
Twitter, I think is the word you're looking for.
So, I mean, yeah. And there's that fine line, right? Virtue signaling is one of the issues. There's more to it. Like I remember specifically talking about the tearing down of statues, and that coincided quite a lot with the growth of the BLM movement again.
Absolutely. Again, it's and suddenly there's more populists, there's more information out there.
Sure. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, at the same time, like sometimes the signaling can go a little far, and I'm not saying that like things shouldn't be done. I remember a particular instance. This is getting into the nerd side of things. There's a what we call a version control software called Git, G-I-T. Sorry, I'm going to try and keep this out of the weeds as much as possible.
Too late, get the weed whacker.
Anyways, you can imagine it as carrying multiple copies of your code, and you can pull back through the history to see like what happened, what changes happened where, who made those changes, things like that. The main line of all of that history throughout the code is called master. Master copy, you get the idea.
Master branch.
Master branch is what this was. The term comes from something like master copy. Mm-hmm. And there was, I think it was the summer of 2020.
Oh, boy.
Maybe early. There was suddenly a huge Twitter thread. Gosh, I remember because I think somebody at GitHub decided, I forget, that they're no longer going to call it master. They're going to call it main because of the master-slave ideology, which actually does not, like, that's the problem with English is we overload terms.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, all the time.
And it was not, like, there are things in computers and computer science where we refer to master-slave, sure.
Who remembers the IDE? Anyone?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Sorry.
That this was not even the particular case. And I was reading through this Twitter thread. Honestly, I couldn't give a crap. It's changing a word for us. It impacts almost nothing. Not a single person in that thread was a person of color.
Well, no, why would they be? They don't care. Out of all the experiences I've ever dealt with, it's white people being outraged for other people, which I think is hilarious.
On behalf of.
And it befuddles me. Like, I appreciate like the empathy side of it, sure. But stop taking up other people's crusades. Like
so that's, how do you support what you believe is a virtuous cause with an empathetic bent without
spearheading it yourself?
Without appropriating it or Columbusing
it's hard,
it.
Right? Because a lot of I suspect, you know, again, I'm very much white, so I
really
don't have a lot of experience being on the other side of the fence. Imagine that. But I suspect that there's a lot of people that don't want to cause waves. They don't want to start a movement.
Yeah.
And so it's probably very beneficial in the sense that some of the people, you know, on our side are willing to take up arms and be like, no, I'm offended for him. You know?
See, I think it's tricky when you're talking about offended for compared to offended with.
Yes.
And maybe with is the wrong word because, you know, if we look at offense, and I know offense gets tossed around a lot these days. Oh, everyone's offended at everything. But if you actually look at the nature of offense and being offended, there is almost like a transaction.
Well, it's personal.
Yeah. And so I don't know if you can be offended with someone if the thing that someone is offended about only really pertains to them.
Well, are you honestly, and I don't think as anybody from outside of a situation can honestly make the judgment. I think it has to be made from within the situation. Mm-hmm. Can you honestly say that you are supporting somebody or that you're trying to make yourself feel better. That's ultimately what it comes down to. Oh, now, sure, we'll make mistakes, sure, but ultimately, if you're about it because this cause gives you the warm and fuzzies, you need to check your motives.
We almost said check your privilege.
Well, it's close. Yeah, it's close. It depends on what we're talking about. And so, yeah, it's, I don't know. We're kind of straying off of the main topic, I guess, for tonight. But it's relevant too, because a lot of the sterilization of history is,
well, that's how things, that's how around, these things are realized in our day to day.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it's that far off.
Yeah.
Topic. I mean, yeah, we're not really talking about should we tear down statues of George Washington.
Well, I mean, we could circle it back around to, you know, some of these historic figures that we, you know, idolize or otherwise put on pedestals, not necessarily, you know, literally, but figuratively. And some of the things that they may have done that we just aren't taught in schools and would have to go research ourselves, right?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of movements that have existed that are like, oh, that guy's amazing, and he did this really cool thing, and it was what he did. But there is this whole backlog of other stuff that leading up to that point, maybe not the greatest guy in the world.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Maybe he was an amazing individual.
I mean,
and then decided to do something terrible, and that's how we know him now.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't necessarily think that's sterilization per se. Like, it's not intentional, right? Mm-hmm. It still technically is obfuscation, and that just may be a limitation of how the knowledge gets out there or how we can consume it. Or, you know, I'm not writing my own blog post about random people in my life. Like, if I could write about you two, that'd be kind of awesome. At least we get the day-to-day mundane stuff, fair, right? And maybe that's the day-to-day mundane stuff that you're going to be known for. Or maybe you decided to go on a killing spree. We don't know.
Wow, thanks. Well,
I think about it.
It would be the ginger.
It would be the
What?
That's terrible.
On that note,
I don't know.
I was going to say, before we start getting into berating figures of history, do we want to break open the scotch?
I think that would be a great idea.
Excellent.
This is your regularly scheduled scotch break.
So, tonight, again, we are drinking the Glenfiddich. It's delightful scotch, single malt scotch whiskey, 12 years. Griff, what do you think of the scotch?
I like Glenfiddich. It's a good scotch when you want something that has a little flavor, a little zing to it, but you don't want to taste a campfire. I personally like campfires.
Me too.
Campfire scotches. The smokier, the better. But every now and then, you know, sometimes it's just you want something a little bit smoother. And this is not a paid ad, I promise. But it's
when you want the smoother things in life. Drink Glenfiddich.
Hashtag not sponsored. Is that
hashtag
not sponsored yet.
Wow. It's definitely different from Ainsley Bray.
What's the flavor profile of this one?
This one,
it's a lot less sweet.
Yeah, there's not as much sweetness there, but it's not like bitter or smoky. It's just, it's almost savory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're tasting more of the barrel.
I do get a little bit of like almost caramel and vanilla. So there's a hint of sweetness, but it's not like dialed up as much as Ainsley Bray was, which, I mean, Glenfiddich is a little more expensive, so that makes sense.
So, but tonight for our Scotch break, we are talking about not Glenfiddich, but the Glenrothes Distillery. So, did you
learn
know
me something, Jake?
There's a ghost story involved with some Scotch stuff, and I always love a good ghost story.
Of course there is.
So I'll post a link to where I pulled some of this information from, but back at the turn of the century... turn into the 20th century, so early 1900s, a distillery was started by Colonel Grant from Roths, I think that's how it's pronounced. But during a Bush attack on basically a track that he was going through in Africa during the Boer War, he rescued a young child named Byway. And I'm not going to try and pronounce the last name because I will definitely offend somebody. And this child basically went to live with Colonel until he died and worked in the distillery that this Colonel started up.
Where's the ghost story?
The ghost story is coming. Hence the when he died.
You
gotta have death if you want to have a ghost.
10-2.
These days.
Yeah. So 7 years after his death in 1972, following the installation of a new pair of stills at the distillery, the ghost of Byway was said to have appeared on two separate occasions in the still room. Nothing sinister happened, but when sufficient concern was raised, they actually ended up calling in the university or professor from a local university, Cedric Wilson. Wilson shows up and apparently talks to this ghost.
Some strong no scotch.
Idea. Yeah, I think he was just getting the fumes from the distillery and decides that apparently the ghost was hanging around because the stills were not in the right position. So once they moved the stills back, apparently the spirit just went away.
Wow, that's marvelous advice for someone who's not even on payroll.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Misalignment of stills.
Plus one Byway?
Byway.
Byway.
All interesting. Right. And that's...
Sounds like a middle manager if I ever met one.
All right. And that's... No, well, he no sounds way more...
Byways out there.
Yeah, that's who. That's actually who we're trying not to offend because, well, middle management. He sounds way more useful than middle management.
Fair.
Yeah. And this is like an origin story of Glenfiddich?
No. I said since we are not talking about Glenfiddich. Do you even pay attention to what I say?
No, he's in his own little world.
Sometimes.
Uh-huh.
He decided to go off on a tangent about a brewery instead of talking about the wine.
This is it?
The whiskey. The alcohol.
You listen when
I feel sorry for our editor.
I feel sorry for him too.
I feel sorry for our listeners. Anyway.
So getting back to
that never happened, by the way.
I don't know how I'm going to edit that.
All of that.
Nope, this particular episode is about whitewashing. We're just going to whitewash the fact that ever existed.
Yeah.
As far as you guys heard nothing.
Man. You are not listening to this podcast right now.
That's a little too meta.
Do not believe what your ears are telling you.
We're getting a little bit Twilight Zone-y.
So, you want to kick us off there, Griff, with a person? You seem to have that idea before we...
There's a lot of persons we could talk about.
Who's the person we're just going to spread libel about? Libel, right? Is that written? No, slander.
Libel and slander are very similar.
Yes.
One's written, one's spoken.
Yes.
Publicized. These days, it's... gray.
Is a post on Facebook written or
yes. Well, here's the problem is that as are most things, as we are discovering in this podcast, it's tricky. Not Run DMC tricky, but it's not cut and dry. And I think that's part of the problem overall with this notion of history and telling history is that it's not cut and dry, mm-hmm. and that the people in these historical moments are humans, therefore flawed, therefore you've got to show all of it.
Right.
Or you're not doing them or the story or the people affected by their actions, you're not doing them justice. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, that's a hard pill to swallow in a lot of cases. And it's not just kind of quote unquote people we would associate kind of with the right, whatever that means. It's not just conservative generals or Confederate generals, not a Freudian slip, I promise. It's not just Confederate generals or segregationists or anything like that. There were quite a few questionable things on the, more, again, quote unquote, progressive side of history as well. Martin Luther King was apparently not faithful to his wife. Generally not a good thing. Kennedy, definitely not faithful to his wife. Abraham Lincoln, taking kind of a shift here, is widely known and justly known for freeing enslaved African Americans, but he was also flaming racist. And it's arguable that he freed the slaves as a matter of political expediency, not so much as a matter of justice for fellow humans, mm-hmm. which when you say that, kind of deflates the bubble a little bit. He did free millions of slaves. That's about all. There wasn't a whole lot of restitution. There wasn't, there was 40 acres and a mule. Beyond that, he used it as a lever to help win the war, which did keep the country united. But
who's to say again, that was the proper response, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, it was what he believed was a proper response at the time. But I think that we are, our original kind of theme for the podcast was also, you know, applying the morals of today to people of the past.
Absolutely. And well, the morals shift, right? I mean, we talked about that previously.
Well, they do. You see, and that's where it gets really tricky is I don't think that we should just totally write off every person in the past who has a less than perfect, pristine record just because they did something that was morally questionable.
Agreed.
Now, the number of morally questionable actions and the extent to which they affected a lot of people, you absolutely need to take into account.
Yes.
But
well, it's not
we have to avoid the trap of just saying, oh, yeah, and they did these things. But it, in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't really that bad. No, it was atrocious.
Yeah. It could be, right?
And
Depending on
which situation we're talking about. Yeah.
I'm going to throw a monkey wrench into this here. Even people in the more recent past who have become figures and symbols, you can probably do your own research on this, but who have sparked some of these, who have arguably been kind of the spark that lit the powder keg of these movements, were not necessarily fine, upstanding citizens, but the instance for which they became known and the effects those instances kind of started, that's kind of what they're known for now. Right.
Well, they're painted in that light, right? Because it's,
yeah,
that was either potentially their last act in some cases, or it's the most great act that they're known for.
Exactly.
And so the idea is that, you know, this person was known for this one thing, which if you actually look at their history, look at their previous lives, may not have anything to do with it at all, right? It may be something completely unrelated and it may not be good or bad or maybe terrible or great. We don't know. We don't really advertise that aspect of it. We advertise a name and basically one accomplishment. It's kind of how it works out.
But I think that the magnitude and the effect of that accomplishment, even if it's not, you know, a meritorious, you know, thing that they did, not something they aspired to do, but just something that they were part and parcel to, that's in a way kind of what a lot of people end up being known for. And I know, you know, a lot of times we say, oh, well, you know, you'll be judged by the sum of your actions. That's the kind of a virtuous thing that gets thrown around a lot, I think. Not necessarily true.
Mm-mm. Well, not in general social consensus.
Yeah, you'll get judged by the actions that people want to judge you by.
Yep, exactly. If there's something about your past they don't like, they're going to bring that up. That is well within their ability.
Or if there's something about your past that people like, that they're willing to
overlook your shortcomings in other areas. Yeah.
That's the question, is where do we draw that spectrum, or where does that needle fall? Because on the one hand, you may have Confederate generals and, you know, leaders of Confederate states who in their private lives were, you know, for the most part, morally decent humans, except they owned slaves.
Right.
You know, or and that probably justifiably negates a lot of, you know, the other stuff that they did, if not all
but
of what
it?
They did.
I mean, that's the problem, right? Looking backwards, we can say that, sure. But looking forwards, there's no way to know. They were fighting for their rights to do that as a daily thing. Well, like maybe the year 2050 rolls around and people doing podcasts are now ostracized.
Well, that's going to be awkward.
One can only hope.
Right?
We won't be dead by then.
I know.
Just remember that.
That's kind of the problem. That's why I wanted to bring that up. Because we have to deal with it.
Fair.
Right.
That's fair, but that's also adding a layer of trickiness onto it, because these people in question, the ones who, you know, the founding fathers and the founding Confederate fathers, they are dead. They can't, you know, speak
for themselves.
Sure. themselves. And so they are judged not by what they're able to testify about on their own behalf, but about what history has said about them.
Exactly. Which is part of the problem.
Yeah. Now, I don't want any listeners to take this as like, oh, the Confederate generals weren't so bad. I think it's more complex than just being, they were bad, they were good. They had a lot of choices to make, and I think they made the wrong choices on a lot of occasions.
Well, they made the choices that they felt were correct.
Right.
You know, and I say we have to shade this in a non-good
or
bad
way. How are we defining correct? Because A, we can't really properly say that because we're not them. We're not there. We can judge by some of their writings, and arguably some of their writings. Yeah. Did Lee honestly believe 100% to his core that slavery was a God-given commandment?
Maybe.
I don't.
What if he did?
I don't know What I do know about Lee is that he graduated from West Point, gave up his officer's commission in the Union Army to fight on the side of the South.
Mm-hmm.
He had the opportunity to do the morally just thing and didn't do it.
And we're kind of wading a little bit into the territory of how we define moral and ethics here, which, funny enough, we've had an episode about that in the past. And so this idea that, you know, we can judge somebody by the fact that they believe they were doing the quote-unquote morally correct thing, I think we have to be pretty careful with that.
Well, we know today, right? You, the fun thing about hindsight, it's 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are now very much aware that was a bad idea. It's unanimous, mm-hmm. right? At the time, it wasn't. There were two groups that were divided in regards to what they felt was right. You know, to bring up, you know, today's standard, right? We have vaccines right now that are very controversial, apparently.
You don't say.
But we have two different camps, one that says yay, one that says nay. Maybe in the future, we're going to deem that to be completely morally unacceptable to who have ever never taken it, or vice versa, that have taken it. You know, we now will never know. That's kind of the fun part. Moving forward, they'll dictate how we're viewed. And I think that's one thing that's very dangerous about us. I don't want to say, you know, giving them, you know, proper or improper credentials, or even just, you know, putting them on a pedestal or otherwise.
Right.
But at the time, they didn't know which outcome was the correct outcome.
Mm.
They were fighting for what they believed in.
But does that exonerate them from...
Not necessarily in today's
I think there's two questions there. One, I don't necessarily agree that they were fighting for what they thought was right.
Really? I'm lazy when it comes to stuff I don't believe in. Real lazy.
But people will often fight for what benefits them personally the most.
Yes,
having a peripheral, it might not be in the forefront of the consciousness, but having a peripheral understanding that what the thing that they want is going to cause massive harm to others.
Sure.
But at the same time, I have to kind of pull back towards the other opposite side of the argument with, and we're not exactly following the topic, with, you know, the anti-vaxxer, I usually am trying to shift the terminology towards vaccine hesitant population because, again, we have this polarizing attitude throughout our culture. Most people on the pro-vaccine side will often say, I can't say most people, that's already me polarizing. Many people who I have come across on the pro-vaccine side will say people who don't want to take the vaccine are doing so because they are lazy and selfish. Or something to that effect.
How about actively attempting to hurt the population?
Or that, or I've heard that. That one's way more of a stretch. I'm just like,
it's a stretch to you.
Dude.
But again, it's what they believe, not what
you
believe.
Sure, sure. And so, but at the same time, like having had a chance to talk with a lot of vaccine hesitant people.
Yeah, you can. But
I'm gonna let you finish.
Yeah, I'm gonna let you finish.
All right, Taylor Kanye. Having had the chance to talk with a lot of vaccine hesitant people, and I specifically say hesitant in this case, not purely anti-vax, which I also know a few, it's more nuanced than that. It's people who have concerns and who may have concerns out of invalid data, but it's the data that they have.
But that doesn't make it any less of their belief.
Right. And so kind of what I'm circling here is the question of, like, especially looking back on history and judging historical figures, can we assign moral correctness to somebody? Can we even know what the true moral good is, which is yet another podcast episode and probably needs drugs. No, I'm not condoning drugs.
Don't do drugs, kids.
That was last season.
That was last season. I don't know. And so I think in these discussions of historical figures, we have to remove moral motive from the judgment of the actions.
Oh, sure.
What does that mean?
Means that I can't for certain say what that person's moral framework was and whether or not they were acting out of their own moral code versus selfishness or whatever. I can assume it if they've written down quite a lot.
Sure.
Not everybody wrote down their 95 theses of morality
in their journals.
I explicitly try not to write those things down for future people to find.
For your political advisors.
He wants to remain an enigma wrapped in a mystery.
I like being able to change my opinion.
Yeah. Well, honestly, Jake, I think you bring up a good point in that how much are we willing and how much are we realistically asking of historical figures when it comes to these morality questions? And I think it's, I don't think that we've done this in that, you know, we're comparing vaccine hesitant people to Confederate
figureheads.
I hope not. We're not by any means doing that because are completely, completely different. Because I feel like when you're presented with a choice that you can see the effects of, and if that's kind of a tricky way to phrase it, let's put these two in conversation now, I guess. So if we look back at historically racist figures, they were perpetuating a system. They were intentionally perpetuating a system that they could explicitly see was harming other humans. You could argue there's a lack of empathy there. You could argue in some instances there's a level of sociopathy there, right? Now, that I think we can ask more of those figures. It's like, you can see this is causing suffering for these people. Why would you continue to do it? Right. Well, and that's where we start having less and less sympathy. Contrast that with something way more nuanced and way more personal, like people who are vaccine hesitant. They probably have no desire to, I would assume 99.9% of them have no desire to further something that causes immediate suffering to their fellow humans. You know, they may think that, you know, this vaccine is not nearly tested enough. We don't really know what's going on. We don't know enough to make a solid choice. And so I don't want to make the wrong choice here. If you substitute anything else, almost anything else in for vaccine, suddenly that becomes a philosophically and morally defensible position.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's no immediate threat to, or there's no obvious immediate threat in their mind to other individuals in their close personal circles, let alone their broader personal circles, it gets tricky. You know, I don't necessarily want to, you know, really demand, oh, you should have seen what harm your lack of vaccination was doing to other people. I don't think we can demand that, you know, because it is very gray in this instance.
Right. And like, we could go on and on about this particular part of the topic because there's also the idea of, like, you have the ability to look at this information. You have the ability to go out and seek objective data and truth and hopefully objective interpretations of that data. Because we're, like, I could go out and look at a lot of case studies and reports and scientific journals on COVID tests with vaccines,
but I can't. The layperson doesn't know how to interpret those.
That's exactly my point, is, like, looking for appropriate arguments of authority is what I would say. There's the concept of an argument of authority in philosophy. It can be valid and it can be invalid. It depends all on who that authority is and are they actually an authority on whatever subject that is. And more often than not, people will default to an argument of authority, even though they won't say it. Like, the argument of authority often boils down to this meme I saw on Facebook. That's
There's an abstract authority there.
Yeah, exactly. That's not a valid authority, probably. Like, unless it was written by somebody who is an authority in that field or subject, it's just not. So,
but as I say, the medium itself really doesn't lend itself to that level.
Oh yeah, and that's another crazy topic. But
how do we want to land this?
I know. Talking about
The wings have fallen off, and I'm pretty sure the prop's stuck. So
we're just gliding.
Let's figure it out.
Sorry, Jake. Go ahead. He took a big swig there, folks.
He's taking a moment.
No, bringing it back around to the whitewashing or sterilization of history. I think we've kind of roundabout hit another potentially more important thesis of how to apply that to today. Because there's a lot of podcasts out there that have talked about, you know, all of the different horrible things these great figures of history and of modern time done. Behind the Bastards is actually a great podcast that I would absolutely plug. I can think of a number of different examples from even just modern, my own stuff, especially again, going back towards the church evangelical sort of stuff. Ravi Zacharias was a huge figure in the media, huge, huge apologeticist, which my view on apologetics is has shifted massively. And I think apologetics is the reason why so many Christians are falling prey to conspiracy theories.
What is apologetics?
Providing proof for God, gospel, scriptures. Okay. That's usually the way it's used as. It's the idea of providing proof almost kind of in the sense of like you're presenting your case to a jury.
Gotcha. Okay. I was thinking like Canadians who are saying sorry all the time.
You're right. I know. It's a weird, I don't know why that term is there, but it's there. But instead of, you know, instead of looking for objective truth, you're trying to say, I have the objective proof and I must prove it to you. And we, especially in Christian circles, often add a value proposition to that. Like, if I cannot prove this to you, then I am not faithful enough, or I did not study enough, or I did not, like, there's a whole lot of trauma. That's interesting.
So how does that tie into the sterilization of history?
Sorry, that was more talking about Ravi Zacharias. Ravi Zacharias was a huge apologeticist. Mm-hmm. He passed away recently, I think last year, not due to COVID, I think cancer. And, you know, he was glorified and venerated among especially modern evangelicals. And it came out, and there, this had actually been known beforehand, but it was just kind of shooed away or whatever, that he was sexually abusing a lot of people. It was huge. And so we have, like, even now we're still looking at that and sterilizing it, and I don't know what to do with it. Now, granted, my view on him has changed largely due to that, and largely due to my relationship to apologetics. I don't think apologetics is a good thing anymore in the bounds of the way that Christians use it. There's been a lot of cases of that type of thing happening within the church, though. Josh Duggar, a few others. And then even more historical context, Martin Luther was, you know, is hailed as this wonderful, amazing saint of the Protestant church. Sure, he did good things. The 95 Theses were important, but he was also a raging anti-Semite. Wanted to literally murder Jews. Calvin, same sort of thing. There's a number of different Protestant saints. We wouldn't exactly call them saints, but anyways. But yeah, I mean, I think applying the idea of, like, we've sterilized history so much from both sides, left, right, up, or down,
everywhere.
But we also do that in current day, in our current, you know, big figures that we prop up or whatever. The right loves to sterilize a lot of the stuff that Bush did. The left likes to sterilize a lot of stuff that Obama did. Obama still let Guantanamo happen. Like, that's,
I think a lot of these boiled down to where the line gets drawn, where we can separate, and I'm going to use a broad term here, the man from the act.
Yes.
And the effects of that act and the moral or immoral life of that man. You know, Bill Cosby is a great example of this. Horrible monster of a person, apparently, now that at least the allegations have come out. But the art that he made was very positive in a lot of ways. And so it gets extremely tricky because you don't want to condone what he was outside of his message, his art, because it's morally reprehensible, you know. But we're still willing to say, you know, the Cosby Show, a lot of which came from his comedy and a lot of which came from personal, you know, life experience, was a net positive for the culture. And that's a very small example. And if we want to blow this up to, you know, bring this back to the, you know, Confederate founding fathers versus regular founding fathers, it starts to get really hard to divorce those evil acts from the men that committed them and from their personal and normal civilian lives. So in a way, we're remembering people like Jefferson and Jefferson and Washington for the ideas that they proposed, even if they didn't really live by those ideas.
Absolutely.
Which is another just black box that we should open on a different episode. Contrast that with the Confederate leaders, and their ideals were subjugation of an entire race, which is objectively bad.
Right.
Just no two ways about it. So I think that's where we have to start to think about drawing that line is, can we separate what these people tried to advance from what they did and how they lived in their time? Wow, that sounded way more profound than I meant it to.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful kind of landing point thesis for this particular episode. Like, what do we do when we see behind the curtain of our heroes?
This is why
close the curtain.
This is why I don't think we should just necessarily destroy Confederate monuments. I think we should put them in a museum.
Well, they need to be contextually displayed.
Exactly.
As opposed to... I think
all monuments should be contextually displayed.
Agreed.
Yes.
Warts and all. I think it should be taught that Lincoln freed the slaves. Also horrible racist.
Yep.
I think it should be taught that, you know, the Confederate generals fought to continue and perpetuate slavery. Some of them might have been nice people on a day-to-day basis. You know, you can't have one without the other. Now, again... you can focus on one more than
as
another,
we do,
but and that as, is as we do. But that's the problem is we focus too much on one. We don't just lay
we,
it.
We
all
pick
bare.
What we want to basically immortalize.
Exactly, exactly.
Cool. Well, I think that's the end of our episode tonight.
we didn't use the rhetoric cowbell once.
I know. Now that we actually have it, you took too long in freaking painting it for an audio podcast.
It's an art, Jake.
Anyways, thank you once again so much for listening. It's a pleasure to be doing it all, y'all. We would love to hear from you on our website, scotchandsocialism.com. Also, come find us on our horridly malnourished Instagram and Twitter account, Scotch Socialism. And please remember to listen and drink responsibly.